Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of June. The current issue of The Atlantic has a cover story, and it's a fascinating one with a lot of depth to it. What Makes Us Happy is the title of the article. Joshua Wolf Schenck is the author. And it's about, I think we did a show on this some years ago. I know I had a chance to interview the study's longtime director when he spoke in Milwaukee a couple of years ago. Here's the story. For 72 years, it's amazing, 72 years, researchers at Harvard have been looking at the question of whether or not there's a good life, and is there some kind of formula for a good life? They followed 268 men who entered college in the late 1930s. Our guest has discovered that one of those was President John Kennedy, but he can't get to the records until 2040. They cover these people through war. Many of them, over half, were in World War II. Careers, marriages, divorces, parenthood, grandparenthood, old age, the spiritual lives, sometimes alcoholism. And for the first time, our guest has gained access to the archive of one of the most comprehensive longitudinal studies in history. And it's also beautiful writing, as he says in his article, What Makes Us Happy? Joshua is our guest. Joshua Wolf Schenck is an essayist and the director of the Rose O'Neill Literary House at Washington College. He's written for many prestigious publications. He has also won awards from the Abraham Lincoln Institute, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and the National Mental Health Association. He serves as a member of the Advisory Council to the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission and the Maryland Center for the Book. And he's a contributing editor to Washington Monthly and has done more than that. He is the author of a book on Abraham Lincoln, and actually we talked with him some years ago about that book. Let me give you the title. The book is Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. Joshua, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi. Nice to have you here. I had a chance to meet George and ask him questions at a symposium for the elderly in Milwaukee a couple of years ago, and I was so happy to read your article because I found the stories just riveting, and he was pretty riveting as well. So here you are some years later writing about getting access to these archives. You were as taken with the whole story as many of us have been.
Yeah, you and I are in a similar place. I hadn't met George before I began this research, but I had read his books for my study of Lincoln. It's quite hard to find psychological material that speaks to a person across a whole life. And Lincoln was melancholy his whole life, but it changed very dramatically from his young manhood, when he was, you know, what we might think of as kind of classically depressed, to his old age, when he was extremely effective and also extremely gloomy at the same time. And I came across George's work as I was trying to find models to explain Lincoln, and especially try to understand how it is that someone's great strengths could coexist with such great debilities.
Right.
That's a big theme of George's work with the men of the Grant study.
Mm-hmm. And we should talk about who George is for people who are not familiar with this at all, how he found out about this study, a little bit about his personal background that certainly motivated him to have a deep interest in the subject.
Well, yes, George is a trained, he's a psychiatrist. He is trained as in psychoanalytic tradition. He's also a research scientist, and he has a very affecting personal story. His father, who was a prominent archaeologist, committed suicide when George was a boy, when he was 10 years old, and George became fascinated after his father's death in longitudinal research, and he doesn't connect it explicitly to his father's death, but it seems clear to an observer that you have this young man who's lost his father, who becomes very interested in sort of tracking people's lives across time and seeing how they change and grow. And he began to do this kind of research on his own, and then he encountered, when he was in his early 30s, this study at Harvard that had started in the late 1930s. George picked it up when in the 1960s, when these men were in their mid to late 40s, and he's been following them ever since. As I say in the piece, he expects to follow them for the rest of his life. So he's really he's devoted an enormous amount of energy and attention to the men and the questions that come up for them. And he's brought to bear a really unusual combination of perspectives. He's both a literary man and a scientist. He is an optimist who really believes that science can help us live better lives. He also has a real tragic sensibility and sees that life is painful. And so much of what we do is not eradicate that pain or avoid that pain, but work with it in ways, ideally, that are productive and helpful to other people.
Mm-hmm. And the study itself looked at some, 268 students from Harvard from 42, 43, and 44. And these people have been studied like nobody's been studied. They've been studied inside out.
They have been. I mean, among other things, the study is kind of a glimpse into the history of medicine and psychology over the course of the 20th century, because whatever technology existed, whatever was, you know, the sort of the latest and best was used to try to get insights into these men. When they were in college, they had Rorschach tests, they had medical exams that were extremely extensive. In the 60s, there were these other more psychoanalytically oriented psychological tests. Now the men are getting MRIs. They're having samples of their DNA collected. They've even requested that the men consider donating their brains to the study when they pass away. Meanwhile, all through this time, they've had questionnaires, surveys that are very extensive, and they're like little, you know, prompts for essays on all kinds of questions: marriage, work, life satisfaction, political preferences. At the very beginning, those questionnaires were sent once a year. After a while, they started sending them every 2 years. And on top of all that, George has himself gone to visit with most of the men and interview them every 15 years. So it's just an amazing body of material. I don't know that there is any body of material on any set of human beings in existence that is so intimate and detailed and revealing as the material in the Harvard study.
Mm-hmm. And the stories do, because of the depth of them, because of the pain of life and because of his work and his brilliance in many ways, these stories are literature in a way.
They are, and this is one of the themes that really interests me a lot, is the tension and the mutuality between science and science and literature. I think science fundamentally, at its core, is about fixing things. It's a very pragmatic orientation. And, you know, the science of well-being says, you know, how do we learn how to live better lives? And it's, you know, there's quite a lot of good that comes out of that. And George has identified some very practical things that, you know, your listeners would probably be really interested in, certainly. Many readers have been interested in so far, that relationships matter, that work matters an enormous amount, that alcohol abuse is absolutely, you know, essential to be avoided, and very concrete things like that. At the same time, you know, we live our lives forward, and we can only understand them backward. And it's the extent to which we can program a happy life is very limited because we have such limited information. And so there's, you know, I think there's a sense of tragedy in all our lives in the classical sense that we're subject to fates and forces that are not within our control. And this study really illuminates that theme too, in a way that I found really poignant.
Right. Do you think that he, and I know he's written a book on alcoholism, some of the stories that you highlight have to do with young men who were very promising, and at least one died of alcoholism at a fairly young age. And some people just, you know, may have been mild drinkers in college and then started drinking a little heavily. And I know his father died of alcohol-related problems as well. Is there a focus on these particular lives in an attempt to understand his father? Because he really does talk a lot about being careful of the drink.
Yeah. Well, one of the main themes of George's work, one of his main interpretive lenses for understanding the world and understanding these men, is the idea of adaptations or defense mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
This begins with Sigmund Freud. The idea was developed by his daughter, Anna Freud. And George Valiant has really become the chief sort of modern explainer and developer of the idea. And the idea is that we're all driven by these unconscious drives, which are some of which are extremely unhealthy and get us into a lot of trouble. So, for example, you know, projection, when there's some kind of deep fear or longing in us that we can't, that we're not comfortable with, and we put it onto someone else. So if we're feeling insecure and we, you know, accuse someone else of trying to make us feel bad, that would be an example of projection. And then at the other end of the scale, altruism and humor. But the reason I bring this up in answer to your question is that, you know, according to George, these are unconscious and they're largely outside of our control. And so we only have limited, and we can't totally see our defenses. They're hidden from us to some extent. So, you know, what extent has George been practicing a kind of sublimation? That's another defense where you take all kinds of energy and difficulty and you channel it into some kind of practical aim. To what extent has he been practicing sublimation in his work with the study? To what extent has he been trying to understand his father through these men? George himself is not aware of that, and he doesn't, you know, that's not one of the things he'll tell you when you ask him, that he's trying to figure out his father, you know, who died of suicide. But it, to the observer, the relationship is feels immediately apparent and
right.
And powerful. That, you know, his father went to Harvard. He died just before his 25th reunion. George started studying these men right around the time of their 25th reunions, and his brother told me that, you know, he thinks that in many ways the study has been George's way of trying to figure out for himself how to live a good life. And I identify with that. That's certainly the reason I wanted to write about the study, too.
Right. And you discovered in going through the archives that President John Kennedy was a member of this study group, but you couldn't get at the materials. That was fascinating.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, it was a coup, a small coup, to even identify him in relation to study, because the men are, all anonymous, and there's been very strict secrecy. There are a handful of men who have outed themselves or have talked to newspaper reporters over the years. JFK, after his death, his files were removed from the study office and they were sealed in the Harvard archives. And when that happened, the archivist made a note about these sealed files, and they identified that they were from the grant study, and so I was able to confirm it that way. And, you know, it would be really, really, really interesting to see what was in there. Of course, JFK had a very complicated medical history and a very unusual paradoxical character. The point I make in the piece is that, you know, it's of course interesting as trivia and it's titillating, but the much more interesting point, I think, is that John F. Kennedy, I think, illustrates better than anyone I know of, he and Lincoln, I think, are both great illustrations of the fact that, a successful, happy, meaningful life is really hard to reduce to a set of rules. I mean, here you have with JFK a man who was extremely witty and bright and energetic and service-oriented. He also was a philanderer. He was extremely sick physically. Is that a happy, successful life? Well, to answer that question, you have to define your terms, and you need to identify your values. And there is no one answer to it. It's a matter of taste and judgment, and it's a much more subtle art than any kind of scientific endeavor. And mostly what we do, we don't try to answer that question in a precise way. We say, well, this is an epic life, and it's interesting on its own terms. And so much of what I found about these men is just that they are epic lives, interesting on their own terms. They raise all kinds of interesting questions. The questions, I think, are more powerful in many instances than the answers.
Yes. And those files, his files, because I want you to write about them as soon as you can, won't be released until 2040. Why is that? That's a long time.
Well, it's a standard thing with sensitive material to seal it for long periods of time after anyone who's connected it to it will, long after they're dead. I don't know that the files will be made available in 2040. That's the earliest that they could be made available. And I sure hope they would be. It would be fascinating.
Yeah, it sure would be. You talk in the article about the healthiest or mature, you talked about adaptations a few minutes ago, altruism, humor, anticipation, looking ahead and planning for future discomfort, which is interesting, suppression, a conscious decision to postpone attention to an impulse or conflict to be addressed in good time, and sublimation. That's a very, very interesting list, isn't it?
It is, and it's, I think, a great way of thinking about, a healthy life. I think very often we get the idea that, that health and well-being and happiness is an absence of trouble. And this study helps us see that, trouble comes to everyone. These men could not have been more privileged in an incredibly privileged time, from privileged social rank at this great school. Most of them went on to really interesting and rewarding careers. Certainly that option was available to all of them, but they all encountered a lot of difficulty and trouble. There were divorces, there's alcoholism, there's, life presents us all with a great deal of difficulty. And so the difference, as George sees it, and from what I saw in the files, he's dead on. The difference between the lives who we really admire and the ones that we admire less is not how much trouble they encountered, but how they responded to it. And those defenses or those adaptations that you just listed are, characterized the best of the responses.
Mm-hmm. What about, you talk about neurotic defenses, which are common in normal people. How much, when you look through the files, did you find intellectualization, which is interesting and maybe specific to this particular group of people from Harvard, dissociation and repression?
Oh, you see it constantly. I mean, I actually had a line in the piece that was cut. I knew it would be cut, that intellectualization, is sort of the house defense of Atlantic Monthly readers. We're trying to kind of, see the world in terms of its ideas. which is great. I mean, it's helpful and interesting, and of course, you know, ideas are really important. But it is often a way of shielding ourselves from sort of the raw, primal, you know, stuff that beats in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Joshua Wolfshank is our guest. I hope some of you have had a chance to read, and if you haven't, it's really fascinating. The Atlantic, What Makes Us Happy? Friends Matter, Cholesterol Doesn't, at least at some points in life. Lessons from an amazing 72-year study. Joshua had access to this Harvard study, which I'm sure many of you know about, studying a group of men considered good candidates for being normal people, and many became exceptional people. And their stories really are all exceptional. 72-year study of 268 men who entered college in the late 30s, and our guest had a chance to look through these files. And the question is, what's a good life? What makes us happy? What gives our lives substance? The number for you to join us is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We have lines open for you right now. Joshua is an essayist and director of the Rose O'Neill Literary House at Washington College. He's a 2005-06 fellow in nonfiction literature at the New York Foundation for the Arts. He served as a member in, well, it's still going on, advisory council to the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, partially because he wrote a fascinating book, Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. So join us. Don't be silent on this. I think it's fascinating. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now. Let's start with Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was wondering why women were left out of the study.
It's a great question. And of course, it's a profound limitation of the study, and one that George Valiant has dealt with as he could. He picked up the files of the Terman study, which is another longitudinal study started at Stanford University in the 1920s, and he looked at those at the women from that study, or a sample of the women from that study, to try to compare them to the Harvard men. He's also picked up a study of disadvantaged youth in inner city Boston, and has followed those men very extensively too. I think that the reason why the study members were comfortable leaving out women to start, I think there are two reasons. I think number one, there was less sensitivity in that time to the need to study human beings in all their diversity. I also, one gets the very strong sense from the early material on the study that they intended this to be just the beginning, that they were going to identify methods that could be used to study human beings, and they were going to apply those to all kinds of different samples going forward. That never really happened, and so we're left largely with these Harvard men. It's a regret. It's strangely, though, it's one that's come up not so often in response to the piece. I've heard from all kinds of people from all over the world in response to this piece, and the lessons from it seem really applicable and intuitive to all kinds of lives and all kinds of situations, which is strange. It really would be hard to imagine if you were to dream up a less representative sample of people than these, these well-off, almost entirely Protestant Harvard men. And yet, I think there's a way in which, looking deep into the lives of any human being, you're going to learn, you're going to see illuminated certain truths that apply across the board.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
As far as assessing happiness, was the assessment by the individuals themselves or by some outside source?
Well, there's both. I mean, they asked the men repeatedly, you know, if they consider themselves happy, they ask them, you know, about the quality of their marriages, they ask them about the satisfaction in work. And at the same time, George Valiant and other researchers, you know, were looking at their lives and trying to make sense of them and interpreting them. There's a tension, of course, between, you know, what we know about ourselves and what truths are apparent about us when other people, you know, look at our lives. And I think that's one of the tensions that is brought out in the study. I mean, you ask someone if they're happy, and you might hear, you know, a resounding yes from people whose lives you look at and say, God, you know, I see all kinds of problems that you're not aware of. At the same time, there are all kinds of people who identify as miserable, whose lives seem filled with enormous meaning and accomplishment. Lincoln was definitely one of them, and I think more great artists and achievers than not, you know, are also, you know, people who struggle quite a lot, and yet who, you know, who do great and meaningful things. Thanks,
Mike, very much for the call. I want to ask you just a little before we go back to phone calls, just a little bit. You mentioned the Boston study as well. And you talk about, in contrast to the other data, the Grant men and the Boston men, you look at industriousness in childhood. And tell me about all the studies and how they deal with this, whether boys had part-time jobs, took on chores, joined school clubs or sports teams, predicted adult mental health behavior better than any other factor, including family cohesion and warm maternal relationships. He concludes, George does, what we do affects how we feel just as much as how we feel affects what we do.
Yeah, it's a fascinating glimpse into, again, something that I think most of us would recognize as intuitively true. I was on NPR with a psychologist a couple weeks ago, and he made a really interesting point that so much of the way the truth kind of enters our consciousness is when we learn something that surprises us. So, you know, if you were to see a study that says, you know, neglecting your kids is a path to happiness, of course it's not true, it's just a hypothetical, you know, you'd be surprised and you'd really pay attention. And a lot of times the obvious points, you know, are harder to, you know, to have penetrate our minds. One of the advantages of this study is that the body of material is so impeccable and exhaustive and has such authority that some lessons that we might recognize as intuitively true can really kind of thunder into our minds because of the force of the material. And I think this is one example that, you know, that of course, you know, being active and engaged is going to have a huge effect on our mental health.
Mm-hmm. Nancy is next from La Crosse. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, I can't wait to read the article.
Yeah, it's great.
And I'm just curious about the effect of the level of spirituality, not necessarily religion or the church-going factor, but the amount of spirituality and the correlation, if any, of happiness.
That's a great question. It wasn't a focus of the study, you know, for many of its years. It has actually become a great interest of Giants in his later years. He served on the board as a non-alcoholic trustee of Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, AA is a spiritual program, you know, designed to aid people in this very material problem of drinking too much. And so, you know, George is very interested in the way that, you know, a connection to something larger and more powerful than our own meager selves is the source of meaning and direction and even pleasure in our lives. And I think that theme, you know, it can be seen subtly in the lives of the men. But religion, so far as I saw, was not a major explicit, religion or spirituality was not a major explicit focus. For much of the study, for most of the 20th century, you know, medicine and psychology and psychiatry was very divorced from spiritual concerns. And we're starting to see in the last 5, 10, 15 years, more and more intersections between those two ways of looking at human experience, which I think is an incredibly fertile and important intersection.
Thank you, Nancy, very much for the call. Tell us a story, because I found this really interesting, and I'm wondering if there might be a male-female difference in this regard. I'd like to see it studied. George told you the story about one of his prize grant study men, this doctor and well-loved husband who got this incredible birthday present from his wife and all of his students. And, well, tell us the story, but it has to do with, for most of the people, and I'm wondering if this is true, most of the people in the study, it's much harder to tolerate being loved.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually, of all the different readers at different points in their lives, you know, will take different things from my piece and from George's work. Probably the piece that has affected me the most is George's teaching on positive emotions, which, of course, we all want to feel joy and faith. And yet, there's something extraordinarily vulnerable about the positive emotions because, you know, where fear is got a very concrete value in protecting you from, you know, from difficulty in evolutionary terms. You know, fear was extraordinarily important in keeping us from danger. Joy actually is opens us up to heartbreak and to the pain. It makes us extremely vulnerable. And this story you just mentioned is a great illustration of how the people have a hard time taking good things in. This guy had practiced medicine. He was a beloved doctor, and his wife asked all of his patients to send him notes for one of his late birthdays. I can't remember exactly which.
70th.
Yeah. She presented these notes to him in this lovely presentation box, and he was extremely moved by it, and he took down the box to show George when they were in an interview, and then he said, you know, I don't know what you're going to make of this, but I've never read them. And what George makes of that is that, you know, to encounter the gratitude and appreciation and tenderness would be, you know, enormously challenging for that man. And it certainly, you know, in my life, I've written a lot about depression and suffering, and I come to that topic out of my own needs. I have a long family history of mental illness. I have suffered from depression for most of my conscious life. Mm. It was revelatory to me to think, you know, there's a big challenge in actually being joyful, and it's a challenge worth taking head on and learning to really let that stuff in. And if you're feeling miserable, I don't say this to blame people who do, because there are lots of reasons why we might be suffering. But one thing that may be going on is that you might just have a hard time accepting a lot of the goodness and love that is around you. And I've really noticed this, you know, since hearing George lecture on this point. I've noticed this repeatedly. He points out that it's very common for people to tell psychologists that, you know, if they're given a compliment and they encounter that same person the next day, they will avoid them.
Isn't that something?
It's fascinating. If you think about it, it really rings true. I mean, think about how hard it is to be praised. Think about how hard it is, you know, to be sung to, for instance, on your birthday, to, you know, to meet someone's gaze. How hard it is for people to have loving relationships. So many of us, you know, spend so much of our time in relationships that are painful and even destructive. And I think, you know, one explanation for this is that the kind of surrender and the risk involved in a loving relationship is hard for us to bear. And of course, you know, when you love someone, you're opening yourself up to a lot of hurt that might come from the person, you know, going away, dying, getting sick.
Sure.
You know, hurt from the person rejecting you, which of course is an ever-present possibility. And yet, you know, what life is worth living without that kind of love?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a fascinating point.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And he never read those letters. Did he ever read them? Do you know?
I don't know.
Huh.
A lot of what's in the piece comes from the files themselves. I read four of them in detail, and I touched on a handful of others. A lot of the material, though, comes from George's work, and I'm dependent on what he's shared.
So this idea of people telling us how much they love us and telling us every day and saying it directly in the eye and expressing gratitude for what we do is better off for them to wait until we're dead?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say to the contrary. You know, let's all commit to taking those risks, because I think it makes our lives better, and I think it makes the world a better place. But I think it's really helpful to see that there's an undercurrent of difficulty running through it. You know, there's a ton of psychological research now on happiness and well-being, positive psychology.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people approach these books and studies in a fairly simple-minded way, which mm-hmm. is to say that, you know, being happier is better than being sad, and of course that makes sense. what is really involved in being happier, and why is it that we have so much misery, and can we accept and forgive ourselves for so much of the pain that we do encounter, because it is, you know, inevitable to a large extent, and mm-hmm. can we accept and see how multifaceted a happy life really is, and how much difficulty is attendant. It's just built in, and not to suffer from this problem. That there's a terrific book called Happiness: A History, and it goes through conceptions of happiness from ancient times through the mid-19th century, and the author, Darren McMahon, points out that, you know, one of the problems we have in our contemporary culture is that we have this idea about being happy so drilled into us, and yet so many of us aren't, and that leads to this peculiar phenomenon of, you know, the unhappiness of not being happy, the sense that, you know, we really ought to, you know, feel much better than we do. And I think there's something enormously humanizing and sane-making about George's work, because he shows, you know, what life is really like. And we can see ourselves in these mirrors and recognize stories, you know, for all the ways that they speak to our own lives, and all the ways that the pain and pleasure are woven together.
Let's go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
The question that you're asking, I think, is really how one would spend his perfect day or her perfect day. And I think everybody should do this. Write this down and accomplish these things through their life. I think for me, I start reading throughout the day the Latin breviary of the Psalms of St. Jerome. Early in the morning, attend the Mass of Pius V, have a very simple breakfast, climb Mount Everest. If I couldn't do that, I'd go to Whiteface Mountain and Lake Placid. Read Ulysses throughout the day. My lunch would be at Ebbets Field, rebuild that and see a game between the Dodgers and another team. Have supper at Antoine's in New Orleans, have a filet. and then listen to symphony, go to a symphony, Mahler Symphony No. 8 with Gigi Mitchell Velasco as one of the soloists. So, and I say this because last year I had actually 4.5 minutes of joy when I was at Coors Field watching the sunset over the Rockies from 8:24 until 8:28 p.m. in a day in June. And that's about what most workers get, 3.5 to 4 minutes of joy every year.
Mm. That's so beautiful. I love that exercise of imagining a perfect day. And I think it's also really, I think it's a beautiful point that, you know, that the joy and satisfaction is evanescent and, you know, it comes to us in these moments of grace.
Yes.
That we should be open to, and that we should also accept, you know, is not going to be our ever-present state.
Thank you so much for the call, John. All right, let's welcome more phone calls. This is a good show, isn't it? You got to read the article, everybody, too, because there's so much to it. It's good. It's really good. It's in The Atlantic. It's the cover story for the June issue of The Atlantic. Or you can go to theatlantic.com. What makes us happy? Friends matter, cholesterol doesn't. Lessons from an amazing 72-year study. And our guest has had access to the archives of that study and done many interviews with the author of the study, who also is a very intriguing man. Joshua Wolf Schenck is our guest. He also has written about Lincoln and Lincoln's melancholy. We interviewed him when that book came out on the book. It's entitled Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. And I do want to tell you that we're reserving the last minute of the show to tell you about our trip to Springfield. We finally put it together. We're taking a trip to Springfield to I love the town. It's Lincoln's final resting place, and it's the place he called home. It was the only house he ever had in Springfield. We'll go there, and, well, I'll tell you all about it at the end of this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joshua Wolf Schenck is our guest, and let's take an email here, Joshua. A listener wants to know if writing this story had any impact on your happiness or on your perceptions of happiness.
Yeah, thanks for the question. This business about the positive emotions, I think, is the big new piece for me. The theme of a study, the theme of the of George's work and of my piece, in many ways deepened a kind of instinct, an idea that I had already been pursuing for a number of years because it was so central to my book on Lincoln. Here's this guy who, at the same time, was one of the most troubled men that any of his contemporaries knew, and of course was also one of the brightest, most energetic, most service-oriented, and in the end, most accomplished. And how do you make sense of that? And I that's the question I live with every day: is, you know, how do you how do you work with a life that brings so much pain and also so much opportunity, and how do you make sense of those two things together? So I don't know if it's made me happier, but it certainly has, you know, deepened my appreciation of these fundamental questions. And I guess I should say, you know, it's my work, and so much of what this study shows is that, you know, doing work that you find meaningful, that connects you to other people, that helps you, you know, add something to the world that wasn't there before, that's so much of what gives our lives meaning. And it's been enormously meaningful to me to, you know, to publish this piece and to see the response from all over the world and to hear people's stories. I have my email address at the end of the piece, and I've gotten a couple hundred emails from as far as, you know, Chile and Ireland and all over the United States too, and you know, people have gone in philosophical directions. They've you know, they've also, you know, told me about their lives. I've heard a lot from a lot of elderly people, you know, who want to, you know, tell me their stories that are as complex and interesting as the lives that I'm telling about in the study.
Right. How did you gain access to all of these archives? Was it through your relationship with George?
I'd never met George. I approached him because I was so fascinated by his work. I read it, as I've said, you know, in connection with my book on Lincoln, and I found myself talking about it a lot. I'm one of these people who just, I'm always interested in ideas about human life and well-being, and it often comes up in my conversations with friends. And at a certain point, I said, you know, I just kind of can't get this out of my head, and I wonder if there's some way to write about it. And I approached George, you know, with that very open-ended query, and he read my book, and he could see that, you know, I was serious about this stuff, and he afforded me a great deal of trust, letting me read this very sensitive material with no restrictions on what conclusions I drew from it, but with an agreement that anything I used from the files themselves I would show to him in advance so that he could take care that the men's anonymity was sufficiently protected. But even there, you know, he exercised no restraint on what I said about them in substance. He just wanted to make sure that identifying details were bare enough that the men wouldn't be identified, even though most of them that I read about in the piece are no longer living. They have this ongoing commitment to anonymity.
And it was affording you a great deal of trust. I think he knew who you were. He's that kind of guy. He can figure people out.
Well, he also plays a role in my book. I mentioned him several times, and he told me I hadn't known this. His work also informed Doris Kearns Goodwin, who, like me, was looking to understand Lincoln, and she came to his work too. And they're two of the most prominent references to his work in the last 5 years or so. And I don't think it's an accident, because, you know, so much of what we get from psychology actually comes from a very narrow source. There are questionnaires handed out to college students in psychology classes, or it's material that comes from clinicians who see people who are very troubled. It's very rare to take in a life, you know, across its many, through its many generations and into its many dimensions. And so, you know, looking to understand a whole life, as I did with Lincoln, and as people are always trying to do with their own lives, you know, there just isn't a lot of material like this. It's very special.
Yes, it is. And so are you. So take that compliment and don't, I'm just giving it to you.
Quite challenging to hear, but I'll do my best to take it in.
Thank you so much. I love the article, and I loved your book on Lincoln, and this is a time for us to talk about going to Springfield, which we're going to do, and yeah, I highly recommend people read what you write. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has been a pleasure talking to you. His piece is in The Atlantic, What Makes Us Happy, and you can also send him an email, which is at the end of the article, jw@shenk.net. And this is a perfect time to tell you that we've got the details worked out, we have the go-ahead, and we're taking listeners to Springfield, Illinois. This is the year to do it. It's Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. I love Springfield, Illinois, and as you know, I love Abraham Lincoln. I love Abraham Lincoln. So we're going to go to the museum, and we'll go to his final resting place and the only house that he ever owned. And we'll go to New Salem, where he learned the law and worked as a shopkeeper. And we'll have a Lincoln scholar with us from Knox College, the co-director of the Lincoln Study Center, Douglas Wilson, who's written lots of books on Lincoln, will join us. We will have a Lincoln scholar from UW Parkside joining us on the bus, and we'll have each other, Lincoln lovers. So call for more information, 414-227-2047. Thanks, everybody.